You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. We are joined today by Dr. Greg Houghton, who is an emeritus professor of history at the University of California and was a founding faculty member at the University of California at Merced. He received a PhD in modern American diplomatic history from Princeton University in 1974 and subsequently taught at Oberlin College, Yale University, and California Institute of Technology, Caltech. From 1988 to 2003, Dr. Houghton was a senior historian and curator, as well as the chairman of the Department of Space History at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum here in Washington, D.C. He is the author of now five books: The Winning Weapon, The Atomic Bomb and the Cold War, Councils of War, Cardinal Choices, Presidential Science Advising from the Atomic Bomb to SDI, The Brotherhood of a Bomb, The Tangled Lives and Loyalties of Robert Oppenheimer, Ernest Lawrence, and Edward Teller, which, by the way, was a finalist for the 2003 Los Angeles Times Book Prize in History. And now he has written the Georgetown set, Friends and Rivals in Cold War Washington, which just came out last week. Dr. Houghton, thank you for taking the time to join us here at the International Spy Museum.
Good to be here.
So your previous four books before the latest one have focused on nuclear policy and nuclear history, which I appreciated because that's my field. That's where I came into contact with your writing for the first time. But your new book goes in a very different direction. What brought you to this topic?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I retired from the University of California about 4 years ago, I decided that I wanted to write a history of the Cold War, more broadly than just nuclear history. But really, Cold War had been a topic I had taught at various places, as you say, for almost 40 years. And I didn't want to write a policy history, just a history based upon documents. I wanted to write about the people who had some impact upon the Cold War. And my inspiration or my model was actually a book that I had written about a dozen years ago called Brotherhood of the Bomb, where I wanted to write about nuclear weapons policy, but again, I wanted to focus upon the people who had made the weapons. That was going to be a book on Edward Teller, and it segued really to a book that was going to be on Ernest Lawrence. And finally, it became really a book on Robert Oppenheimer, since Oppenheimer was the most fascinating figure, and he really takes over the book. In a similar way, Joe Alsop, the columnist, takes over the Georgetown set.
And I think that's what's really refreshing about this book, is that a lot of times people have attempted to write books on the Cold War, and they've primarily focused on the heavy hitters, the Eisenhowers, the Trumans, you know, going even into the Secretaries of State or Defense. And really, this brings it down to the personal level. And, you know, these aren't average citizens. These are, you know, these are publishers. These are very famous people, even, you know, former ambassadors like George Kennan. But it's not the president. It's not the people in the White House. And it's really looking at people that are making policy, but behind the scenes. You want to talk a little bit about why you chose these individuals versus the higher-ups.
Right. Well, as you say, the book is really about the pundits, the publishers, the diplomats, and the spies who happen to live in Washington. And it was a matter of good fortune, at least for this historian, that they all lived within a 6-by-8-block area. And pretty much they got together on a regular basis on Sunday evening in what was a Washington institution, a Georgetown institution, called the Sunday Night Supper. And the suppers rotated between the various houses of the people, but primarily between the Alsops, the Wisners, and the Grahams. The Joe and Stuart Alsop were among the premier pundits of the Cold War. They wrote a column called Matter of Fact that was published in, at their peak, about 200 daily newspapers, four times a week, with a readership of about 25 million. So they had an influence upon opinion. The publisher in this case, or publishers, were Phil and Catherine Graham, owners and publishers of the Washington Post, which is one of the papers that published the Alsop column. And the spy is a lesser-known figure, Frank Gardner Wisner. But Frank was head of essentially the Department of Dirty Tricks, covert operations from the very early part of the Cold War. He was head of the Office of Policy Coordination in the State Department. And OPC was actually, Office of Policy Coordination was a term of art meant to fool Soviet spies, I suppose. But it really was the covert operations arm of the U.S. government. And later, Wisner went on and headed the Plans Directorate of the CIA. So he was a central figure in this. In fact, actually, the coup in Guatemala, the coup in Iran, had Frank Wisner's fingerprints on it. So the dinners would circulate between mostly the Alsops, the Wisners, and the Grahams. Joe Alsop's salons were probably the most sought after and the most raucous. Basically, there would be about a dozen people at the dinners. There would be, besides Joe Alsop's own tribal and good friends like the Grahams, there would be senators, congressmen, some young leading figure in the new administration who had secrets of state that might be of interest to Joe and his column, and people like that. So that these suppers would take place, and they were a way for Joe to get information for his column. They were a way for the Grahams to find out things as well that were of interest to their readership. And probably also for Frank Wisner to learn secrets, because he would invite foreign diplomats to his parties at his house on P Street, and it was rumored that the parties were actually subsidized by the CIA, because this is where Frank was able to get some of his information.
Well, it might also be a place where Frank Wisner can influence the heavy hitters in the policymaking in Washington D.C. as well, whether it's senators or congresspeople, to keep CIA doing what it was doing. I mean, you talked about the idea of writing a Cold War history. I mean, this is the time period where the real big decisions are being made during the Cold War, from 45, about the two decades at the beginning of the Cold War. And certainly, from an intelligence perspective, this is when the CIA was at its peak, certainly during the Eisenhower administration. But from a broader diplomatic history perspective, this is when the decisions that would shape the next 40, 50 years of U.S. foreign policy were discussed and arrived at. And the interesting thing to me about this book is that this wasn't this big, broad national conversation. These policies were really designed over dinner on Sunday evenings.
You know, designed and promoted, and there are stratagems connected with them. You know. And it turned out that Joe and Stuart's column, Matter of Fact, which ran from the last day of 1945 to the end of 1974, was actually a very convenient time regarding the Cold War, because it covers the spectrum of events, as you say, from the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, the creation of NATO, the creation in 1947 of the CIA. And the Alsops, by the way, were advocates of a civilian CIA early on, because they did not want the power of J. Edgar Hoover to be extended into foreign lands, since he was already in charge of domestic intelligence. So, and it goes up to the Pentagon Papers, and then, of course, at Watergate. So that period, 1945, almost 1975, and the end of the war in Vietnam, was a perfect era for me to focus upon and use Joe Alsop and Stuart Alsop as the foils for the story, right, if you will.
This actually predates your time period a little bit, but how much actual collaboration or at least connection do these people have during the Second World War, during the time before the early Cold War, when they were coming in? I know a lot of them were very prominent members of either the OSS or of Washington intelligentsia, during the Second World War time period. Is this where their relationship began to be fostered?
Very much so. As a matter of fact, these people knew each other. A lot of them knew each other from the war and actually from the OSS, that Stuart Alsop had been a member of the famous Jedburghs, which were the three-man commando teams parachuted into occupied France to help the partisans. So he was already known to Frank Wisner, who was also in the OSS, head of the Romanian operation there. So it was not, they were so close, in fact, that Frank Wisner asked Stuart Alsop to come over as his deputy at the Office of Policy Coordination. But Stu decided he'd rather be a journalist than a spy. So he stayed with his brother and wrote the column. So a lot of these people, in fact, were close friends in the intelligence community and remain friends and actually remain neighbors as well at Georgetown.
What kind of relationship did this group have with the Dulles brothers during the 50s?
Well, again, actually, Frank Wisner had worked for Alan Dulles, and Alan Dulles lived around the corner from Joe Alsop.
Right, no, so, I am.
So it's a bit incestuous, but they all knew each other, and in fact, Joe complained, Alan Dulles would be, and Alan's wife, Clover, would be frequent guests at the Sunday night salons at Joe's house. And Joe invited Alan in part, certainly when Alan was CIA director, to try to wheedle some secrets out of him. And the story, and it was very frustrating for Joe, he said, because Alan would begin some story that would have as its punchline some important secret. And the story would meander along until it got to the point where you got to the interesting part, which was the secret. And Joe would sort of lean forward, and Alan would theatrically look at his watch and say, "Oh, goodness, how late it is. Who knew? Clover and I must leave immediately." So it was kind of a bait and switch, I think, right. for him.
Well, one of the occasional guests at some of these was a young, at the time, senator from Massachusetts who would later become president of the United States, and that's certainly talking about Jack Kennedy in this case. Mm-hmm. How much influence did this group have on Kennedy when he becomes president later on?
Well, Joe Alsop was, in fact, a pretty good friend of John Kennedy's early on, and Kennedy moved into the house on N Street right down from Ben Bradley in 1957. Actually, the relationship between Joe and John Kennedy went back to, I think, 1946, when Joe was friends with Kathleen Kennedy. But they remain friends, and of course the story that's always told, and I think pretty well known, is that on inauguration night, that after the inaugural ball, that Jackie Kennedy went back to the White House, and John Kennedy went to Joe's house at 2720 Dumbarton, and was a surprise guest, actually. Joe wasn't expecting him, and there's a knock on the door, and there's a cortege of Secret Service cars out in front, and there, standing in front of Joe, is his friend John Kennedy. So he invites Kennedy in, and Kennedy has the champagne, the Dom Perignon that Joe always had in the refrigerator, but he passed on the signature dish that Joe had, which was the terrapin soup, and he couldn't stand.
What's interesting, of course, is that Kennedy's relationship with the intelligence community didn't go very well, certainly after Bay of Pigs, and there's a lot of tension during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and very famously, Dulles was unceremoniously asked to leave after Bay of Pigs. And it wasn't just Dulles. It was several members below him as well. So the relationship couldn't have been saved by these Sunday night dinners, or was it just too broken at that point?
No, well, Joe wouldn't have had the influence or probably even the interest in trying to hold on to Alan Dulles and some of the other people, actually, who worked for Dulles at that time. So Dulles was cashiered. And Frank Wisner had actually had one or two nervous breakdowns by that time. He was manic depressive, and he was, about the time of the Bay of Pigs, he was sent off to London as chief of station, just to sort of to have a somewhat easier job than what he'd had before, but less strain on him. So there are letters, for example, between Richard Helms and Frank Wisner from this time that where Frank is expressing his disappointment and his chagrin that our chief, who was Alan Dulles, has now been fired, and that things will probably be very different now at the CIA. One thing just to add to that is that Frank Wisner had no compunction about planting stories that favored the CIA in Joe Alsop's columns. And in fact, Joe went to a couple of foreign countries, to Laos and to the Philippines, in the case of the Philippines, during an election to promote the CIA favorite candidate, not in his columns that were widely read back here. So, and Joe was later asked about this by Carl Bernstein, and Joe admitted that he did services for the CIA and that he was glad to have done that, and he thought that newspaper people actually should work for their own country, so he had no apologies to make.
Well, that's one of the most fascinating things about this book is you see this close-knit relationship between the press and the intelligence agency and the foreign policy community as a whole that obviously we don't see anymore, and clearly not the case today. And this, is a time before Watergate, a time before the Church Committee, a time before the press sees it as their job, in this case, to uncover perhaps bad behavior. This certainly would never be able to happen today. I can't imagine this as something where the publisher of the Washington Post, which I guess is Jeff Bezos now, sitting down with the CIA director, even the head of the Department of Operations or something at CIA, and having this kind of a conversation. There's just not that level of trust, number one, but also it's hard to look at a so-called free press that has these close ties to the government.
Right, right. Well, Joe Alsop said that there was and there should be, in fact, always a constant tension. I think, in fact, he called it a war between the press and the intelligence services. But in my book, I say that this was a war in which Joe Alsop declared a separate peace, that he was actually quite close to the CIA. But it had to do also with, as you say, his type of journalism, that he believed in what we would now call elite or access journalism, which is where your source on the individual you're reporting on is the individual himself or herself. So that one reason that Joe completely missed Watergate is that his sources were on that story were Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon. So, and who were not telling him the truth about what really went on there. So he completely, for more than a year, he missed the importance of Watergate, and even tried to get Kay Graham to stop taking the Washington Post down a dead-end road, as he said. In fact, actually, what really happened, of course, in at that time, and the story of Watergate is a story not of access or elite journalism, but of investigative reporting by Bernstein and Woodward. And it's a totally different approach than what Joe had been used to, and in fact became the new normal for journalism. My own feeling is that it probably has gone too far the other direction, that every reporter now believes that his or her story is really Watergate and that they need to find a case of malfeasance, where in fact it might be just simply incompetence or absent-mindedness that was the culprit.
Yeah, well, you see the extremes on every side, and I think that's a segue into what I was going to ask you next, actually, about what I knew certainly from studying diplomatic history during this time period, but what is certainly reinforced in this book is the idea of a strong political consensus about the direction of U.S. foreign policy, about the idea that just about everyone was thinking along the same, that there's very little space, very little polarization in the American political system. I mean, even the Kennedys and the liberals are Cold War liberals. They're hawks. They're strongly anti-communist. They're agreeing with their Republican counterparts and in most senses about how to carry out the Cold War. Certainly the polarization of Washington is far less pronounced than it is today. And to a degree that allows for some kind of the coordination and cooperation that takes place during this time. I mean, even people like Paul Nitza and George Kennan, who would not be anywhere near each other on the political spectrum. Of course, Kennan's a very, very liberal and Nitza very much on the other side, are working hand in hand on a common goal. And so is this something that you see as a reason that people from different fields, whether it's journalism or intelligence or foreign policy or national security, can feel as though they can come together and have this joint discussion about the future of the United States?
Right. I think it was essentially unspoken that there was a degree of trust and confidence between these people because they had the shared experience of the Second World War. And in the Cold War, the shared belief in an anti-communist consensus. And so that, as you, these, I think this sort of union of thought was just unquestioned. That even and you mentioned Kennan and Nitze, that Kennan and Nitze were both frequent guests at Joe Alsop's table. I'm not sure on the same evening, actually. I suspect not. But they were both guests, and they were both sources for Joe's reporting. So I think that there was a degree of common thinking, or at least the same thinking that existed with that greatest generation, that certainly is not at all evident today.
Center, as you mentioned, to your book is Joe Alsop, and there is a scandal involving Joe Alsop that involves foreign intelligence, and it may, you know, we assume it's well known, but it may not be fully understood by a lot of people listening today. Certainly people of a younger generation have never heard of the scandal involving Alsop. Can you talk us through a little bit the background behind this scandal?
Sure. Joe had always wanted to go to the Soviet Union and be in what he called the belly of the beast and report from Moscow. So in early 1957, he goes to Moscow. And while he's there, he basically is ensnared in a homosexual honey trap. And he's staying at the Grand Hotel. He's approached by a man he describes as blonde, youngish, athletic. And this man is called Boris. And Boris basically seduces Alsop. And after what the Russian document will call the act, two men burst into their room and confront Alsop and say and show him pictures of he and Boris naked and say they now have evidence that will ruin his career, and he had better cooperate with them for the cause of peace. Alsop wasn't sure what to do, but he later thought he might have to commit suicide because his career would now be ruined. But instead he decided to play out the game to see where it would lead, as he later wrote. And he contacts his friend, who was Chip Bolin, Charles Bolin, former Georgetown neighbor, who is now the American ambassador to the Soviet Union. Bolin finds out a little bit about what had happened. Bolin contacts his friend and Joe's friend, Frank Wisner, who is now head of the plans directorate at CIA. And Wisner tells Bolin that you have to get Joe at this time had gone to Leningrad. You have to get Joe back to Moscow. Joe has to write an exact, detailed account of what happened with Boris, and you need to send that to me, and I will give it to Alan Dulles, and Alan Dulles will give it to J. Edgar Hoover. And once the CIA and the FBI know about this, and Joe has been open and frank, that there will not be any basis for blackmail, that this will pull the sting from the KGB blackmail threat. And that's exactly what Joe does. He actually writes an 8.5 single-spaced account, 8.5 page single-spaced account of the of what is called the Moscow incident. And I actually FOIA'd the documents from CIA and have the letter that Alan Dulles wrote to J. Edgar Hoover, including the what he called Joe Alsop's confession of what had happened. And it was stamped top secret eyes only. It was meant to be kept as the very top secret. In fact, actually, Alan Dulles asked Hoover to keep it in a special safe and not allow access to it from anybody. And the secret was actually kept despite the fact that there were subsequent attempts to blackmail Joe Alsop from the KGB and actually, I think, from the FBI, from Hoover himself.
And potentially from the Soviet ambassador at some point, Dobrynin?
What happened is the incident occurred in 1957. The secret is pretty well kept. It actually doesn't come out fully until after Joe's death, and about 5 years after his death. He died in 1989. But in 1970, the photographs that have been taken back then start appearing in the mailboxes of Joe's enemies and some of his friends, actually, in Washington. So the question in my research question I had was, first off, who received the photographs and who had sent them? The photographs were, there was a letter included with the photographs that basically was unsigned. This was, in 1970, and the letter said, in effect, you'll see from these photographs what a despicable person Joe Alsop is. You should know that he was... these photographs were taken by Israeli intelligence, by the Mossad, and the reason that Joe Alsop is so favorable to Israel is because of this blackmail threat. If you look at the timing, Joe had just written a column, several columns, critical of Soviet policy in the Middle East, in one column that was a personal attack upon the Soviet ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Dobrynin. And my own conclusion is that, and I knew that Dobrynin knew about the Moscow incident because of a conversation that was recorded he had with Henry Kissinger. So my own conclusion is that Dobrynin is the most likely source for having sent these photographs around with an intent to basically tell Joe, knock it off and don't do this, don't criticize me directly. Joe would continue to be very anti-Soviet in his columns, but he would not be anti Dobrynin. And the other part of the story is that Richard Helms, who was then CIA director, also knew about the photographs, and friends of Joe went to Helms, and Helms, in his memoir, says that he then approached the KGB and said, knock it off. If you send, if these pictures keep on going around, we have ways of letting the world know about what some KGB agents have done that they would not want exposed.
And Alsop, like most people who fall for honey traps, in hindsight, probably should have seen it coming. From every description I've heard of Alsop and some of the pictures that I've seen, he wasn't a stunner. And, you know, it's always the 60-year-old balding middle-aged heavyweight guy who runs into the 19-year-old Russian gymnast and thinks he's his lucky day, and it just turns out to be a KGB agent. It seems like the Alsop-Boris rendezvous probably should have been seen coming a mile away.
Yeah, and Joe actually admitted that. In fact, the first line of his so-called confession is that this is the story of a dreadful mistake, or words to that effect.
Well, absolutely fascinating book. It just came out. You can pick it up anywhere great books are sold, including the Spy Museum gift shop, the retail store.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we will see you next month.